Alright people, welcome back to Hitter Mentality. Today we have Mr. Tommy Hawkyard. Tommy is a director of content for Ben Meir. He is also the author of Dear Younger Me, a newsletter where he shares one piece of actionable learning advice from his work under Ben. Why are young men struggling more than ever with no one talking about it? In this episode, we expose the real data behind why young men are struggling more than ever. Why are men earning less, dating less, and losing purpose in a world that's supposed to be easier than ever? We dive into what's driving this quiet collapse and how to actually fight back. Can you believe that 25% of young men claim that they experience severe loneliness in their daily lives? From the role of mentorship to the hidden power of community, this episode gives you a tactical playbook to build confidence, attract real relationships, and reclaim your identity in a distracted world. With that being said, let's get into the young male epidemic and cue the intro music. Tommy, why is this conversation around young men actually important to have right now?
I really appreciate that question, Rishi. I really think that we are at an inflection point in our society, and I think one of the biggest fulcrums of whether or not we go into a direction of prosperity versus ruin can really hinge on this conversation around young men. Selfishly, it's because I'm one myself and care a lot about people like the two of us and generally our group of individuals. But there's a lot of very scary but intriguing data behind some trends about what's going on with our generation and specifically with young men going on. Young men are working less than they normally have in the past. They're earning less than they normally have in the past. They are dating, having sex, and in relationships less than they have in the past. We can dive in all this, these data points more in depth, but all of these things are, in general, what I would say is like leading to a nervous future if we can't get it right. Obviously, it's going to affect people like us, but it also affects everybody involved. It affects the people that have raised us. It affects the people that we'd be in relationships with. It affects the businesses that we may be a part of eventually. And at the end of the day, it also affects future generations, Rishi. Like, if young men can't become inspired to change and to grow and be better, we may not have younger generations. We may not have the businesses of the future that can continue to propel the prosperity of not just the American nation, but nations as a whole, and to just continue on this great human experiment. I think it's a really important issue and something that I hope that this conversation can continue to bring light to and continue to inspire others and continue to get more people talking.
I feel like every generation has their challenges and they love to emphasize their challenges. What about this crisis is actually scary or something to look out for, especially now?
Yeah, I think what's scary about it is never before in our history have we seen what's occurring with this generation. This is the first time in history that a 30-year-old now is earning less than their parents when they were 30 years old. Prosperity is less for on average people that are growing up and developing in today's day and age than they were back in the day. And unfortunately, that leads to a lot of tough things. It leads to anger, resentment, division, the development of radicalization, incel groups, things of that nature that can just be very concerning and can be the fractures to a nation. I'm sure you feel this a little bit, and probably the listeners do as well. Like, the polarization of not just where we live in America, but just over the world, it feels like you're always trying to step on people, like you're always stepping on people's toes, or you don't always want to say the wrong thing, is causing a lot of fractures. And I think that's why this issue, above any other issue, Rishi, is so important. Is because I wouldn't say there's something that we've preset or predated in history before this. Like, I think history can be a great teacher for us about learning about things in the past and learning from the past to not repeat similar mistakes in the future. But never before have we seen data like this. In general, things continue to grow on this upward trajectory. Generations of the future are more prosperous than generations of the past. And it's the first time that we're really seeing a reverse in that. And I would say that's pretty scary.
You know, it's weird because it's a weird paradox, because objectively, technologically, we're eating better than some of the kings from 200 years ago. Almost everything that we have now is better than what we have 100 years ago. But for some reason, our well-being is at the lowest.
Yeah, I mean, you got it spot on. Mental health is declining. As social media has gone on a rise, it's inversely correlated to mental health and like just general mental well-being. Something that's, like, I would say the pinnacle of that is, especially with young men, like if we're talking about disproportions, young men actually commit suicide 3.5 times more than their female counterparts of the same age, which I think is so tragic and so sad. But yeah, it's like we have the tools of the gods at our hands. I mean, like, could you fathom, like, the King of England of the 1600s having something like this at their phone, like having something like their phone, like at their like fingertips? We really have godlike tools, better food, better transportation, everything like that. But I think sometimes in this Frankenstein way, it's like the more we try to pursue something new and different, sometimes that can strip the humanity away from us, and a lot of that data can back that up.
It's staggering because I feel like there's always a stigma around the fact that young men typically have it the best. You know, not to get in anyone's faces, but we had this rise of feminism, and rightly so, maybe women were underappreciated a lot of the time, but I feel like with this new rise of feminism, there's also become this, with that has come along this new rise of almost just anti-men, where we have to put down the other gender to rise one up, which personally I think is ludicrous. I think each role, men and female for me, like, they go up together, they go down together. And I think as of right now, the world I live in, it's almost like if we say anything about men needing something, it's almost like, well, where's the woman? And it's vice versa. It doesn't seem like there's an actual real partnership.
You're spot on with that. And I think the biggest, and I really appreciate you bringing that up, because I think the biggest preface to a conversation like this is that the conversation for pro-men does not mean the conversation for anti-women.
Exactly.
Anything like I think like the rise in the feminist movement, or like the blossoming of women in the workforce, like a growing amount of women as CEOs, a growing amount of independence and empowerment from women, is an amazing, amazing, amazing thing. This is the first time in history where for every $100 that a man in his 20s makes, a woman makes $110. So like women are actually out-earning men at a earlier age, which again is an amazing thing. And I think you're spot on when you say, Rishi, like the species in general goes up and goes down with the thriving or with the collapse of each generation. Like, we want women to be at this stage where they're at now. They're super empowered. They're in the workforce. They're gaining more positions of leadership. But at the same time, we want to continue to have men that can not only thrive as well, but also like be there to almost like get back to the level of women. Like for so long, like I think like the system and everything like that has kind of pushed women down. And I think the rise of a lot of this great stuff for women has almost like catapulted them up. And we'll dive into solutions and things like that, that or things that men can do to take action to get back to that. But I think in order to get back to that, where both sexes of the species are thriving, like we need both men and women to be thriving.
Tommy, we know the statistics you just brought up. Men are 3.5 times more suicidal, and I've got a statistic here. 1/4 of young men, I think it's the ages 15 to 30, report extreme loneliness in their daily lives.
Yeah.
Does this crisis stem from a failure from society, or is it, do you think, a lack of almost self-responsibility?
It's a great question. I think it's a mix of both, Rishi. I think there's been a little bit of a society has always propped up men, and now that there's been like an equalization moment, it's unveiling things within systems and within like the lack of programs that really can support young men. Regardless of all of that, I'm one to say of like, at the end of the day, it comes down to radical accountability. Like, you have to be the one at the end of the day to seize opportunities that may come, or get out of your comfort zone, or enter into pain in order to get to or uncomfortable situations to get into like positive growth. But I mean, the number one, I was reading this really interesting research report that actually came out in London called the Lost Boys Report, and they noted that when the first time that a young boy starts going off the rails, starts potentially doing like little small petty crimes, or starts getting more in trouble at school, or maybe gets into juvie or gets in trouble, all of that usually happens when they lose an older male role model. Which is super interesting. And so I think there's a little bit of there's total radical responsibility, but then within that, there's also things where, whether it's actual systems created by the government or it's just strong older men, can come in and actually build in things of mentorship, of big brother programs, things of that nature that can actually support young men to be able to fight back against troubling situations. Like that's the number one cause of like when young men first go off the rails, it's due to a lack of an older male role model, typically a father figure or someone like that.
Why do you think that is?
I think, again, like motherly bonds or having like an older feminine role model is super, super important. But I think in general, like, we have a very loud society. On social media, we're told 100 things about what to do. In schools, generally, I think it's something like over 50% of school teachers are female in comparison to male. So there just isn't as many male role models out there. And I think we're pretty simple creatures. Like, men are pretty simple creatures, but we're also really impressionable. Probably even more impressionable than females at the same young age. There's another stat that both when like young boys or young girls face some sort of like sexual crime or assault case, men are, I think, 10 times more likely to end up committing suicide than women. So women are just a lot more resilient. They're a lot more able to fight back against adversity. And in comparison to men, transparently, or young boys, I should say, need more handholding. And having a role model that's a male that can help steward along a young boy into becoming a man is so, so important. And when you really don't have that hand to hold, that older male to look up to, you turn to the noise. You turn to what you see online. You turn to what people that haven't necessarily walked the walk are trying to tell you to do, and often that's when things come off the rails.
You know, it's so unfortunate because I come from a very privileged background of having two parents who've stayed together lovingly. And this Lost Boys report, it seems to hone in on this idea that a male figure is very important. And the unfortunate part is, as a child, you obviously can't control that facet of your life, whether a father's there or not. And I'm just wondering, there's obviously an age or a point where maybe you can't control that. Find a mentor. Finding a male figure, maybe. What should we, do you think, look for in a mentor? Because you said have a brilliant one in Ben or other ones in your life.
100%. I think there's three big pieces of the pie that young men can kind of take action on, in terms of how to fight back against this crisis and how to really be a man. And one of them is exactly what you're saying is mentorship, finding actual mentors, and specifically male mentors that you can grow with and that you can model after to continue to grow yourself. Like, it's actually insane, some of these stats about what happens when you have a male mentor as a male versus when you don't. Like, especially when you're younger, pre-college, you have two times a better chance to go to college if you have a mentor versus not a mentor. Insane statistics, especially when it comes from like lower underprivileged households. Mentored men are 55% more likely to find employment than non-mentored men. It's pretty incredible the data that comes up when men have mentors. Really, I think having mentors is a complex and scary thing for, I think, young men to go out and do. I think there's a lot of advice on the internet about, like, if you can't find, like, a physical mentor, then, like, use mentors online or use, like, role models, like, your favorite social media, like, people that you follow or people on TV. And although I think those can be, like, helpful... role models, 100%. Like, all those can be helpful role models. I think, like, actually having a mentor or a board of, like, personal board of directors that can actually, like, be in a lived experience with you is so, so important. It's funny, I've had a few mentors over the course of my young adult life, and I usually use the same script no matter what. I usually try to get them over the phone or sitting down and having a cup of coffee with them. And like, I legit ask them if they'll be my mentor. Like, I usually start and I say like something I really admire about them. I really want to learn and grow with them. And then I legit speak the words, I'm wondering if you would be interested in being my mentor. Cause I think that there's sometimes like, you may have a teacher or a coach or a boss that can act as a mentory figure, but actually like speaking those words I think is so important, because then that person can have a vested interest and can have a label to the relationship, which I think is super, super important. And then it helps really frame a little bit more intentionally like what that person can do to serve you. That person then is like, oh yeah, if I'm your mentor, like what do you want to do? Do you want to read a book together? Do you want to set up monthly meetings? Do you want to go out and do activities together? Versus kind of like, if you're not asking these people, it may just be, if it's a boss at work, maybe it's just the only time you hang out and get to ask questions is during a feedback or review meeting or after practice with a coach or whatever that may be. So I think actually having the courage, and it always feels awkward every time because it's something that's so underutilized, I think, as a tool. But if you have a coach or a teacher or your college best friend's dad or uncle or whatever that may be, and you find that this is someone that you're really interested in becoming, like being mentored by, then I think it's so important to like actually go out and use a script like that and ask someone to be a mentor.
Yeah, I mean, asking someone to be a mentor, almost the first step seems to be finding a mentor. And is that first step of finding the mentor actually looking at someone and going, that's someone I want to emulate? That's someone I want to become. That's someone who I see as a clear role model for my path ahead of me. What are the qualities you think that define a good man mentor?
Yeah, I think I've always had like the personal idea of having different mentors for different areas of life. And sometimes you can have kind of these overall encapsulating like life mentors, which I've been very grateful to have. But like when I was really interested in trying to continue to deepen like my relationships, and when I was dating Abby and wanted to get continually more serious and like what that meant to be like a really good boyfriend, then fiance, then future husband, I reached out to a former like manager that I worked for, who also had recently taken the job as like the president of a Christian camp counselor and had been married to someone for 30 years or so. And I was really curious about like, hey, can you help mentor and shepherd me along in this area of my life about relationships? Because I wanted to get better at relationships, and I saw that this man had 30 plus years of experience with marriage. And so that was something that I was interested in. And so that was something that I asked about. It could be the same thing if you're trying to get better, if you want to run a marathon, like, and you come across a guy who ran in college and you want to be mentored by that person. Maybe that's the quality that you're looking for. I really think that the quality is more specific to the scenario of your life that you're trying to be mentored in. But then also, it doesn't just mean like, okay, that means I need a relationship mentor, a fitness mentor, a business mentor, a friend's mentor. Like sometimes there's these rare combinations of men that are kind of this like chocolate and peanut butter combination of multiple different things that you're like, I really want to emulate you. Like I really admire like how much of like a business tycoon you are, but also like how great of a friend you seem to be to the people whom you love. And sometimes there's these combinations. So really I think it's doing a little bit of self-reflection and being like, where am I falling short, or where do I want to grow, or how can I try to improve myself? And then from there, it's kind of opening up that Rolodex of people who you may know and admire, and going to them.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've maybe missed out a crucial step as well. It's because in pursuit of a mentor or a man that you want to become, it's also about, tell me if I'm wrong, but actually identifying the man you want to become, the characteristics. The issue I have is, you brought it up earlier, we live in such a polarized world right now when it comes to the definition of masculinity, because we've got this one very conservative red pill, the Andrew Tate, you know, like, men have, like, shouldn't show their emotions, they should be going after women, and then we've got this very woke, liberal definition, which is basically, you know, masculinity is a very subjective topic, it's up to one's discretion. How do you find the right balance?
It's a great question, and I really think it's about trying to define what it really means to be a man, and then trying to live out the different categories. And for me, in my brain, I try to break it up into something that's almost formulaic, something that you can point to different things. I mean, like, these are the different ways in which I can grow. I've really, in my experience, reading a lot of reports, listening to a lot of people speak on this matter, I really think for masculinity, it comes down to three different categories. I think it comes down to the attainment, or I would put it in three categories: resources, health, and relationships. I think focusing on trying to maximize those three things are what it really means to be a man. With resources, it's legit just money and wealth. Because we live in a democratic society, because we live in a capitalistic society, like, that is something that drives a lot of things for us. That's something that's really important we can dive into. With health, I think a core pillar of what it means to be a man is to be able to protect someone else, being big and strong, being able to, as Scott Galloway, who's someone I love to follow and learn, an NYU professor, that's right, loves to talk about, like, you want to be bigger, strong enough to be able to, if shit hits the fan in a room, to be able to either kill and eat everybody or outrun them. So taking care of your health, and then with relationships, that's romantic relationships, that's friendships, and that's mentorships. Like, being able to try to maximize all three of those pillars, I think, is what it means to be a man. And it allows you to really focus in on different things versus trying to just listen to what I would say is the outside noise.
You know, it's funny. You've created three almost separate pillars, and I'm sure you know it as well. I feel like in my mind, those three pillars are so interlinked. I want to talk about the money piece first because I think that's very interesting. I saw the similar podcast with Scott Galloway. I think it was with Stephen Bartlett about the dating crisis. And they brought up this incredible concept that I actually was fascinated by. Women, like you said, obviously now, at least young women, are now making more at a typical consensus across the board than young men. And biologically, young women's, maybe this even connects into relationships, but young women's standards for a man is at least the ability to signal future resources. So if young women are rising in the pay grade and men are dropping, well, the standard's getting higher and more men are falling out of that standard, it seems like men seriously have an issue there.
Yeah, I think you're signaling the exact, like, that conversation with Scott and Steven. In reverse order, the three things that women look for in men are, number three, that they're caring, number two, that they're smart, and yeah, number one, their ability to signal resources, like you said, is the number one most important thing. And I think it shows in the data. Like, 66% of women between the ages of 20 and 30 are dating or in a relationship, but only 33% of men between 20 and 30 are in a relationship. So what does that mean? That means that women are dating older men. They're looking at their current peer group and they're saying, you're not where I need you to be, and so I'm going to go up the food chain. I'm going to look into men that are in their 30s or 40s or even older, where they probably have better jobs or have better pay. They're a little bit more emotionally mature, and they've had experience with dating and with what it looks like to live in the real world, where, like, they've quite frankly matched the level that a lot of women in their 20s are looking for. And so that's, I think, what's really important for men in their 20s to really understand, is to say, okay, if you reverse engineer that, what are the things that guys in their 30s are doing that I need to be doing now so that I can be on the same level of what women are quite frankly looking for? And it's those three things exactly. It's the ability to signal resources, make some money, number one. But it's also these other two things. It's about being able to signal that you're smart. The number one way to do that is to be able to make a woman laugh. If that's a really easy way to signal that you're witty and that you're charismatic. And the number three, that you're caring, like, you're out on a date, that you're nice to the wait staff, that you tip the concierge, like, you tip the concierge or the person that's getting your car after dinner, that you're kind to your parents. Like, those are big things that men can do now in their 20s to signal that they're at a mature enough level to match the standards that women need. Because quite frankly, men's standards for what they want in a partner are way lower than what women want, which is not, like, that is not an indictment on women at all. Like, women should have gold standards, and it is our responsibility as men to meet those standards, I think. And those are the three categories that I would say are most important.
You know, it's weird because I think you're spot on. I think men typically have lower standards. And we brought up this idea earlier that men are doing worse in an objectively better world. Is it actually that the world has become too easy nowadays? Because all this seems to be is life skills that you develop. Is it because we're not able to develop these because we don't have the challenges to develop these?
Like, there's almost too many choices, and so because of that, like, you almost freeze with the amount of choices that you have.
Yeah, I mean, like, almost think about it this way. Like, men nowadays, and I'm not sitting here on my, like, high stool, like, you know, I'm speaking from a very resonating place. We don't typically have that urge to, okay, go talk to a woman now, because guess what, you can turn on the internet, turn on pornography. Like, people are not leaving their rooms. That's what it feels like.
Yeah.
It's so easy to get everything that you typically want for a lower dopamine hit with a lower restriction with boundaries. It seems like we're not actually going through the harder challenges that develop these skills.
You're spot on with that. Because of the advancements of technology, you basically can have anything that you really want at a cheap dopamine level in an instant, which I think does two things. One, it dramatically decreases the motivation for young men to actually go out and try to find like a partner or a job or anything like that. But it also, if you take a little bit more of a positive spin on it, has never been easier for a man to stand out, especially a man in his 20s. And so I really think it's like, if you're able to have a playbook of how to separate yourself from the rest, your competition is quite frankly, like amongst your peer group, is lower. You are having to compete now, if we're talking about relationships, like young men in their 20s have to now compete against like more developed men in their 30s and 40s and 50s. But that's kind of what it takes. And it's trying to build a little bit of a playbook and an action plan to go out and meet those standards and kind of fight back against a lot of the temptations of the world, whether that's like instant sexual gratification through things like pornography or like instant money through things like crypto or day trading or things like that. It's actually like going out and getting your hands dirty, failing, and growing from that. And that's the thing that I think really separates what I would say is the people that fall into the cheap dopamine like that you're saying and the people that really get the spoils of the riches.
Yeah, I mean, let's start with that first facet that you talked about, the first category of money. What habits or skills should we be doing as a 20-year-old man? Because here's the thing, I'm still in college as well. There's a stigma that, oh, you know, you should be in college. You don't need to worry about the money part right now. Just work on your education. Part of me is like, I don't like that idea too much because I don't want to just go into the workforce completely blind. What should I be doing right now?
Yeah, I think it's a really important thing to be thinking about. And I'm not going to stand up here saying like that I've made it or that I've attained the bag yet, but I really think that there's three things to think about in relation to gaining and growing in wealth and money. I really think it's about the first step, learning it, then making it, and then keeping it. I think those are the three categories that really matter in terms of money. And I think for a lot of young men, a lot of college students, you're not necessarily in a job. You're actually like taking on debt or paying tuition to get education. But that doesn't mean that you can't learn it. That first step in attaining money is learning it. I think there's so many books and resources and YouTube videos to be able to learn how to speak the language of money so that eventually when you get that first job, when you start to accumulate money, those are things that you have that foundation of so that you can actually like learn how to make it and know what you're doing with the resources that you start to gain. Like, I think there's a couple books that are so important for like all young men to read in relation to money. Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel is like a absolute must, talking about like why we think about money the way we do. I'll Teach You Be Rich by Ramit Sethi, like a great way for anybody to start to learn how to build a money system, how to have money work for you without necessarily having to go in and pay your credit card yourself because you have something set up to do that. Building a budget, we talked about this a little bit before the pod, but like The Almanac of Naval Ravikant, thinking about money from this perspective of leverage and what that looks like in the internet economy. Those are three things that three books that I think all young men, and quite frankly, all young people can read to learn about money, even if they aren't necessarily making it. Like, that's what I would say is like a really tangible first step. And along with that, something that I think is equally as important, that it doesn't necessarily mean only college kids can start this, but I think that there's generally a stigma about money. You want to be humble. Like, you don't usually like to say what your salary is. You don't usually like to say how much you're making or how much you have or how much you've invested. But I think the problem with that is that the less you talk about something, the more that you can learn about it, the more that you can actually master it. Like, whatever subject you study in school, like, you're going to become more or less like a master of that, because you literally talk about that subject for 2 to 4 to 6 to 8 years, like, over the course of however long your schooling is. So of course you're going to become familiar with it. But for some reason there's a stigma about, you don't really talk about money, you don't really talk about how much people are making. Like, but the thing is once you can get past that initial, like, oh, I need to be humble, it doesn't necessarily mean that you need to be pompous and bragging about everything that is in relation to how much money you're making or how much other people are making. But really it's about a posture of learning. Oh, wow, this person's making $80,000 a year, and this is how much he or she's paying in rent. This is how much this person has invested in stocks or bonds, or this is how much this person's paying, like, spending on what. Oh, this is all new information that I get to learn that I wouldn't have known otherwise, and then everybody can grow from it. It's an accoutrement of growth and compounding, like an investment. It's like compound interest, and the more that people can talk about it, the more that people can help learn more about money.
You know what? I'm gonna fight back here for a second. Not against you, against the general public, right? Because as a podcaster who's got a very self-help based podcast, one of the first things I hear is, guess what, Tommy? Money can't buy happiness. Now, as much as I try to understand that, I truly believe I will not be able to understand that money can't buy happiness until the point when I get money. I feel like it takes money to understand that money can't buy happiness. And I don't mean to be discrediting about it, but I've never heard someone who doesn't have a shit ton of money say, hey, money can't buy happiness. So there is a clear well-being factor that for me is linked with money, or maybe a life revealing concept that you find out once you get that money. So I do feel like attaining money is crucial.
Yeah, like, I think there is that data point about, like, you actually do get happier and happier as you gain money, up to, like, I think it's like 70,000 or 100,000 or whatever that
I'm
number
sure
is.
I'm sure it plateaus. And
it plateaus, but still, like, there is a certain threshold of, like, you have to make money, and because of that, like, you do gain happiness as you learn more and more of it. And I think part of it, too, is almost, like, as you, like, a couple mentors of mine that have done really well in business will always say, like, sometimes it's not even about, like, oh, I'm gaining more money and thus I'm gaining more happiness simultaneously. It's almost like, because you gain more money, you can use money to solve money problems. And then after you have enough money to where you can solve all your money problems, that's basically like, if you have a tank of happiness and you have a bunch of holes that are getting poked at from, like, money problems, if you can clog up all those holes with money, then naturally your happiness isn't going to drain as much because you just don't have those problems to deal with. That doesn't necessarily mean that, like, you won't have other problems with relationships, with health, with other things. But I think the thing is it may not cause you to be happier. Maybe it allows you to do new cool things that will let you be happier. But from what it seems to be, it's almost like it allows you to have a safety net that prevents you from being more in despair after you reach that certain threshold. But I'm with you on that. Like, I don't think that money doesn't help you become happier.
Yeah, I think it was Jimmy Carr. I'm sure you know Jimmy Carr, the British comedian. He had this brilliant concept, which is, if you start to make money and it doesn't make your life better, you're rich. And I think that's outstanding, because at a certain point, money will always help you out. But then you reach a point where you go, hold on, I'm living the life that I want to live. And that's when I think money can't buy happiness. Because once you really attain the life that you truly want, which can be attained through money, there's no higher ceiling to reach. And I think that's where money can't come in. But that initial foundation is built by money.
Yeah. Yes. Agreed.
Second facet, health. What are we doing wrong?
Yeah, it's interesting. A really sad statistic is only or 25% of men or young men are, would say that they're dissatisfied with their bodies. So, like, if you're in a friend group of four,
yeah,
and you're walking out to a bar or you're just hanging out, at least one of someone in there is going to be dissatisfied with themselves. I mean, like, they look in the mirror and they are sad. They are upset, which is really disheartening. Like, you don't want to have that lack of confidence in your own body. And the fact that 25% of young men do is pretty challenging. Jesus. But again, there is a solution, and that is these health things. Like, a personal anecdote, I've always been like a pretty tall, scrawny, skinny kid, and I was definitely one of those people that fell into that 25% statistic of, like, I would be relatively discouraged when I would look at myself in the mirror, or like when I would have my shirt off, or whatever same, that would
mate. Be. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think that there's a level of confidence that you can grow through focusing on health, through this second pillar. And I think that the amount of confidence that you can gain from investing in your health, or thinking about and improving your health, trying to maximize that threshold of masculinity, is arguably even better for your confidence, or, like, speaking anecdotally, feels like you're even, like, more confident, easier to make new friends, easier to go out and talk to strangers with a healthier, fitter, stronger body than necessarily with, like, having more dough in your pockets. Again, it's kind of like this, it's probably pretty similar, which is why I think it's good to have those pillars, and, like you said earlier, how they're interconnected. But I think there's a couple different ways in which to think about health. The first thing, similar to money, is if you're not consuming it, if you're not thinking about it, if you're not seeing it on your social medias, then you're not going to be thinking about it as much. You're not going to be inspired by it as much. You're not going to be able to have as much knowledge in your toolbox to try to help you out with that health aspect. I always think that there's a couple social media followers that are really worth it to follow on Instagram or TikTok or X or wherever you get your socials. Dr. Peter Attia, who wrote the book, I think it's called Outlived, but he basically writes about, like, longevity. He's a great person to think about when it's about thinking about longevity, thinking about great exercising. I think Andrew Huberman obviously has the Huberman Labs podcast. From a health perspective, I think is one of the best out there. And then Dr. Kristen Holmes, who is the head scientist of Whoop, like the wearable band. Yep. Good stuff. I'm glad that we're Whoop brothers. She talks a lot about health holistically, from diet and sleep and exercise. I think following those three accounts on socials is just going to help you, like, start to take the baby steps necessary with your health. Yeah. Just, like, even if you're scrolling and manage to stop on one of their reels, like, you might just get that little slice, or you're scrolling through their, like, stories, and you click on something and theirs pops up. Like, just having the knowledge of starting to think about health is going to help you take greater steps later on. Similarly, I think with, like, if you want to get fit, if you want to get stronger, if you want to get faster, if you want to really improve your health, I think surrounding yourself or finding a mentor or a coach that can help you with that is something that is so important. I'm pretty lucky because my younger brother played Division I football and had a ton had a ton of, like, really great coaches and strength and workout plans. And so I was like, yo, you're, like, literally going to college. I mean, for more than that, but, like, to basically, like, play sports and, like, be athletic and be, and, like, have this, like, pillar of health. Do you have any resources that you can help me with? And he helped me, like, put together a workout plan, which I've been sticking to for a long time. And it's helped me gain muscle, and with that, gain confidence and be easier to, like, look at myself in the mirror with confidence. So whether that's a friend who's really into lifting, or looking online for a coach, or reaching out to the kinesiology or health departments at your schools, like, trying to find someone to help you, hold you accountable to growing in your strength and endurance and health, or to help put together resources that can help you. with that is so, so important, I think. And then this is kind of like a funny third thing, but there's this test that I was reading about that I thought was pretty interesting, which is called the mirror test. And the first time I saw it, I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, this is so cringy, but it is actually so helpful, I think, for any young man or woman, but I think in particular for any young man that wants to grow in confidence with their body and try to maximize this level of health. And it's really like a nighttime routine, similar to how you would brush your teeth or floss or do a skincare routine or whatever that is. And it's at night before you go to bed, when you're looking at yourself in the mirror, just take your shirt off and stand in front of the mirror and you can't look away.
Like, oh, that is so
look at what you see, flex if you want, but you can't look away. You just cannot. And maybe it's only 5 seconds that you can do it. But then the next night, try to make it 6 seconds, and then 10 seconds, and then 15 seconds. And it's the thing is, it's especially if you feel like you're one of those guys that's in that 25% and you're unconfident in your body, or you just don't feel comfortable in your own skin. This exercise is so painful. I'm not going to like sugarcoat it. It can be so painful when you start, because we're literally looking at our problem, like eye to eye, which is kind of a rare thing to do. And then learning how to just sit in that and witness it and look at it is so important to be able to end up becoming comfortable with it over time. It's either gonna become easier and easier as you do more reps, as you be able to look at it for, as you be able to look at yourself for more and more time, or it's gonna probably motivate you to be like, I can't continue to look at myself be in this way over and over and over again. Maybe you start hitting the gym, maybe you start going for runs, maybe you start eating healthier. And then over time, it just becomes easier and easier and easier. But that's what I would say is like a really tangible way to what I would say is like attack confidence in relation to health with the male body, that I think a lot of guys really experience, and is something that like is really actionable and literally can only take 5 to 10 seconds when you first start, and then hopefully you can continue to add seconds, and maybe even sometimes a minute or two by the time you become super confident in yourself. But that's a test that I would say is a way to really level up your health.
You know, it's so good, because I spoke to Giovanni Vaccaro, who's a founder of Glam Squad, but I did a whole episode with him about routines and how to create your dream life through habits. And one thing that really stuck with me was that this idea of confidence, we tend to conflate the idea that we can just become confident right now. And he basically said, hold on. Confidence is the result of doing something. You become confident through your actions, not by just saying it. And I think Alex and Mosey might have like a similar idea. But to me, that was game changing, because I was always the kid who woke up and never did his bed. And I know it's such a cliche thing, because people say do your bed, and I never did it. And finally last year, you know, I was like, screw it. Why not just make your bed? Those little habits and promises that you make yourself, they are genuinely, I know it sounds so stupid, like people are gonna be like, Rish, you're just being cliche, you're being so, like, you're trying to fit in with the norm. It helps out so much more than you think. And I think the first step, which is why the mirror test works so well, is accepting where you are not confident.
Yeah.
And yeah. If once you accept that, you've already done the main step of realizing your self-help journey.
When confidence is a skill you can learn, it's I think that's what like you said, it's something that I think a lot of people just think confidence is a quality trait that is innately within someone, and you either have it or you don't. But just like you were saying, it's something that you can learn through practice, through actions, through building habits, and hopefully that's a practice that a lot of young men can adapt to try to hopefully become more and more confident.
And you know what? It's I hate to say it, but I will say it, because I think I've got to be real on this one. I was the very, very skinny kid growing up as well. I finally started hitting the gym, so I think I'm a bit bigger now, but I'm not like exactly where I want to be. And I'm going to say the hard truth about it. Not only do you gain respect from yourself, you do gain more respect from others around you once they do see that you're getting bigger and more healthy. It's just a thing I've noticed. Maybe it is a placebo effect, I don't know, but I truly believe that it is something. I'm not saying people look down significantly on people that don't, but there is a level of respect that you do slowly start to attain, because people just see that your exterior, they in their minds can imagine how you built up that exterior, and that exterior was built through good choices that you've made.
Yeah, brother. I mean, biology is undefeated. Like, the people that survived, our early ancestors, the people that survived were the people that were the strongest, the fastest, the people that could hunt and kill and protect. And so naturally, the tribe gravitates toward that person as the leader. So you're spot on.
And finally, the last thing was, you said, surround yourself with people who are better than you. And this is, for me, the number one thing I truly live by. So I'm so happy you brought it up. I truly believe you are the average of your five closest friends. And I saw this thing the other day. If you're obviously with people who don't go to the gym, don't ditch your friends. It's not like that. But you're spot on. You can change certain other parts of your environment to fit that in. Change your social media, because don't get me wrong, I'm a serial doom scroller. But I have a second account, which is all basically like inspirational crap, like those shit.
Yeah.
But it gets me off the bed. It seriously does. Like, Higher Up Wellness, I don't know if you know who he is. This guy just basically like screams no nonsense straight down the camera. And I feel so bad about sitting in that bed. And those changes make a difference.
Yeah, 100%. This third pillar, relationships, I think you can break it up into three different parts with romantic relationships, mentor relationships, which we talked about, and then friendships is this third one, which I think is so important. Since in just 30 years, in 1990, they did a big poll out of a lot, I think it was men average 18 to 40. So a little bit bigger of a sample size. But back in 1990, only 3% of that group of men said that they couldn't name a single friend. Now in 2025,
they couldn't name a single friend.
They couldn't name a single friend. 3%.
As in they had no friends.
As in they had no friends.
Okay.
Now, 30 years later, in 2025, 15% of
young
men can't name a single friend.
You're joking.
Yeah. 5x'd since in just 30 years. So we're in this loneliness epidemic, 100%, like you said. But again, you have to be able to have the tools and the ideas to be able to fight back against this. Like, we are in an epidemic. We are in a loneliness epidemic. But there is a solution. There's a way to combat against this. One of the things that I had a great business school teacher who coined a phrase that I loved, and it was to a keynote that he gave to a bunch of freshmen that were just starting their college careers. And his closing remark and his biggest piece of advice, he said, was never eat dinner alone, no matter what you do. You can spend an entire day alone, but whatever you do, you cannot eat dinner alone. And it may seem like a simple concept, but that really requires some effort. You got to be able to at least spend 5 to 10 minutes with someone while you eat a meal. And obviously I think there's different ways to do it. Like, you could call a friend on a phone or FaceTime them. But also, I think it forces people to like reach out and like actually get dinner with people and like sit down at a table and like engage in community with other people. Like, it's challenging, but again, like, we're up against all of these things that makes it convenient not to do that. But I think in order to really maximize this third pillar, in order to maximize relationships and specifically friendships, like, that is something that I think we as young men can all adopt, is like never eating dinner alone. Obviously, it can be really hard. Obviously, it's going to take requirements and planning. But I thought that was something that was so impactful that I was like, I need as many young men to be able to hear this, and just young people in general, as possible. Is this idea of eating never eating dinner alone. That's like one of a few different tactics that I would say is super important for like friendships and those types of relationships.
For the 15%, by the way, that's crazy. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm just like, I'm still trying to grasp the idea that 15% say they, I'm not saying I don't believe them. It's just so insane to think about. Maybe that's just my privilege kicking in. I don't know.
It's really tragic. It's really tragic. But I think it also, if you think about it, makes sense. Like in a world where we have things like social media, where we have the convenience of entertainment, people are staying in more. Like remote work has never been higher. It's never been more convenient to be entertained through things like Netflix and social media. And so because of that, just like social circles haven't grown at all. And like you said, like loneliness has skyrocketed, which is a huge tragedy. But again, like with every type of epidemic, there has to be some sort of cure. And so being a young man and learning different tactics to be able to fight back against this so that you don't become one of those 15%, or we can decrease that number for people who may not feel like they have any friends is so important.
Yeah, and even for the 15%, let's say they don't have that person to get dinner with, and I'm going to speak from my perspective, right? It's not like I have the biggest friend group. I'm lucky enough to have people that I call my best mates. Sometimes, you know, I can't get dinner, or sometimes where I'm away for a month. What do we do as a 15% that don't have someone to rely on to go out there and create relationships for ourselves?
Yeah, I think a huge thing is developing a third place, which is something that has, again, decreased over time. But a third place is basically this concept of you have your two places. You have your home and you have your work. Or like if you're a student, you have, with being a student, it can be a little bit mixed up because you kind of have your home, you have like is also your work because that's where you study and all this other stuff. But I think as you get out into the real world, like when you leave like the academic setting, you have your first place, your home, and then usually you have a second place, which is your work. And back in the day, there used to be a ton of facilitation of a third place, which could be a gym, church or temple, or religious place, like a local pub, bar, restaurant that people, like young people, would meet up against, an intramural league that you could be able to go to and sign up and join. And that has definitely diminished in the post-pandemic world. But I think if you find yourself being one of these 15% of people, again, similar to everything that we've talked about, there's no easy solution, but there is solutions and there are tactics that you can take. And I think one of them is experimenting and trying with new third places. Like a personal anecdote, I lived with a few roommates last year, and me and another roommate joined a gym because we both were like, okay, we have our apartment and we have our workspace, but like we don't have this third place and we're kind of becoming insular. We're not meeting any new people. And so we joined a gym. And funny enough, like maybe we'd hit the gym and we'd be like by ourselves, but like we'd go to the sauna or steam room or just like be hanging out in the lobby afterwards. And like the amount of just conversations that happen, the amount of like relationships that start to get built solely from like sitting next to someone while you're in a sauna or while you're just chilling out in the lobby, like drinking a protein shake or whatever. It just expands your surface area for meeting new people. So I think being able to find a third place that just puts you in the presence of other people where you can eventually like get lucky with someone tapping you on the shoulder, and maybe that turns into a great friend, a roommate, a business partner, a potential future romantic interest. I think that's a huge like tactical way to combat loneliness, is like try to find a third place, whatever it may be, and dive into that, and that can definitely help facilitate new friendships.
Yeah, I also do have a bit of sympathy as well for people who struggle with this a lot. I spoke to Richard Simon, author, last week, and he wrote this book that's coming out about how he turned his phone off for a year. And we talked about the fact that people, even in public spaces, are not looking to talk anymore. They're not looking to actually participate in the aura of these public spaces. And that's why I find a lot of sympathy for these people, because yes, we can go out there, but at the same time, we also have to take that extra step of taking that action of, yeah, maybe someone will tap us on the shoulder, but a lot of the times it may have to be us tapping someone else on their shoulders.
100% right, Rishi. I think that's like that's a huge part of it too, is like the first and probably the hardest step is like getting out into the space. But then the next more important step is being able to like tap that person on the shoulder. And I think you can also be creative with it. Like like was saying, trying to find spaces that diminish the chance of like always being on your phone. Maybe that's just like randomly signing up for like an intramural team where like you're playing a sport. Like you can't just be scrolling TikTok when you're playing soccer out in the field, or else you're going to be looking like an idiot. But I think things like that, where I totally agree with you, like people are definitely just on their phones regardless out in social spaces now, but then trying to be creative about like, okay, where would this potentially be at a lower spot? Maybe it's like a church or temple or religious group where like there's small groups where like you're technically just supposed to like sit and talk with each other like without your phone. That's something that maybe is a creative way to do, besides just like maybe going out to a bar or a restaurant or like joining a sports league or things like that, that can just increase your chance of being surrounded by people while decreasing and diminishing the amount of chances that there are that someone's gonna be on their phone.
I agree, and I take a lot of, not pride, I think that's the wrong way of saying it, in the fact that, like, I openly say that I didn't have the best freshman year. I'm not saying that was bad at all. Like, people have gone through a lot worse, but I openly talk about how my freshman year definitely could have been more vibrant. And one of the first steps I took was, look, I think I realized that a lot of it was maybe down to the fact that I was sitting in my dorm a lot of the time because I felt like I had not that many relationships to rely on. So I was like, all right, well, when I'm not busy, just sit in my dorm and read or do some shit. And then I took the step of going, hey, let me go sit in the library. And you would think that crazily impacted me, and I'll be honest, it benefited me a lot. But at the same time, while I was surrounded by people, it still felt a bit lonely because it's not like anyone's looking to talk. I think this idea of actually forcing yourself to be in groups where participation is almost mandatory, like an intramural team, is crucial. Also for the fact that, I don't know if the intramural teams are free, maybe they're not, but when I spoke to my trainer a while ago, he basically said, the way I force my clients now to attend my sessions is they pay in advance. They got to put skin in the game before coming. If you put skin in the game, you are forced to go, and that almost forces you to create relationships.
Facts. Yeah, like there's a one thing that I did last fall that was so beneficial on many different levels was I actually joined like an improv class for the fall.
Oh my God, I want to do that so badly.
Like that was one of those things where it cost a couple hundred bucks to do it and you had to pay in advance. And then it was like every Thursday night it was like, okay, well, I have to go now because if not, then I'm burning whatever the 30 or 50 bucks a class that would be. And it forces you to be surrounded in a space, like go. Even if I was like, work was really tiresome today, or I just am not feeling it, or I don't want to be social, or I don't want to talk to people. It was like, well, I'm going to be burning this. I'm paying the money anyways, like might as well go. And that's like another thing too, where I know we're talking a lot about like intramural leagues or like church groups, which like that might not be your cup of tea, but something like a skill building class, not only like can help you learn something new, but will also again like put you in the agency of others that may also have a similar passion to
interest,
you.
Yes.
Which is kind of this great combination of like, not only am I making myself go out there and do an activity, which is going to force me not to be like on my phone or not be like lonely in a busy place, but it also is probably going to surround me with people who are like-minded, interested in the same hobby or passion as me. And like, I don't know about you, but like my closest friends and I have a lot of things in common. Like that's probably what makes us like, that's what makes people friends. And so it's like, it almost feels like too good to be true, which is, it is like, it's just it's just that. It's something like that can be so, so beneficial as well.
Dude, have you seen these, like, the run clubs around the nation? They are so funny to me because it's almost, we've talked about friendship now, and maybe they're all for friends, but it almost seems like these run clubs are, like, the source for romantic relationships as well.
I have a friend who is literally, like, had never been able to really, like, find a girl that he liked, was always, like, pretty serious about, like, if I'm going to date someone, I want to date them to try to marry them, which is great, but was, like, I've never been able to find the one. Literally, like, went to a run club, first run club, like, you see them start to hit it off, and now this guy is, like, head over heels for this girl, like, they're so in love, and it was, like, literally run club. I'm like, if you have any interest in running and you are single, then, like, join a freaking run club. I swear you'll find love.
Dude, and it's not, like, and yes, maybe you're not even interested in running, but it's not even, like, that hard. I've seen these run clubs, like, half the time, they're not giving a shit. They're taking the piss. Like, it just seems like a very clean way of people who don't drink, who don't go out, to meet people.
100%. And I think it's one of those things, too, where it's, like, we're seeing something that I'm really encouraged by our generation, like, despite all these statistics and data, is, like, you're seeing all of these things pop up that are, like, a fight back against loneliness, a fight back against how easy it is to not make friends. And it's things like these run clubs that are facilitating community. And it is those types of people that are, like, I understand that this is an issue and I want to make new friends. And it's, like, that is so encouraging to hear.
And I feel like that perfectly also connects to the romantic relationships, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's a similar thing with romantic relationships and friendships. Like, we talked about that data point already of 66% of women in their 20s are dating, but only 33% of men.
That's so crazy. Because
it's crazy, but Like we talked about before, it's knowing how us as young men can grow and develop ourselves so that we can be suitable partners to women. And it's not like any of these, what I would quite frankly say, are like the misogynistic tactics of the Tates and the red pill side. But at the same time, it's not like the, what I would say is like the blue pill side of like a very unconformed gender structure, or like to be a man means to be everything. Like, funny enough, the three things that we talked about are like the three most important qualities. It's like the ability to signal that you can attain resources, like not necessarily meaning you have it, but like being able to signal it, which maybe you could say is like a little bit like getting money is a little bit more of like a naturally masculine thing. But like having compassion, like being caring and like showing that you're smart, I would say that that's like a unique thing. And those three things are, I would say, like the three things that young men need to be able to focus on to find a suitable romantic partner. Honestly, I don't think it's much more than that. I don't think it's much less than that. It's really like, how can you try to, again, maximize those three steps that women find most attractive in men, according to data, and go out and do it.
Yeah, and I think it's it's almost in a good way, because it's not the fact that we have resources, it's the fact that we can show that we can attain resources. And I think, for example, if you have a healthy body, guess what? That's already an ability to attain resources. If you're doing the things that we've talked about, they all interlink. I am interested, though. A lot of the times I've seen very healthy relationships start off as friends. You and I were just talking about you and Abby and how you started off as friends. And yeah. I feel like there's this culture around, oh, if you want a girl, you got to cold approach 20 women, as many women as you can. I'll be honest, I've had like a teeny taste of it. It doesn't really work for me that as much. I don't know if that's just a me thing. I tend to find that like a lot of the time, friendships are the way to go.
Yep. I think that the first tactic that you mentioned is definitely a tactic. I don't necessarily think it works as well. I can't remember the exact data point, but I almost want to say like one out of every three friendships that start at work end in like a very consensual, like romantic relationship, which I think aids to your point a little bit about like usually a lot of these romantic relationships start as friendships or start as colleagues or start in like a platonic way, just so that you get to know someone, like just so that you can get to talk to someone. And then over time, it almost becomes an easier way to reveal to yourself, like reveal to you and that other person, like who you truly are without necessarily having to put up the blockades of like, oh, I'm on a date. I need to be on my best possible behavior ever. I don't have any flaws, like, which is clearly untrue. It almost is more organic and easier to develop a romantic interest if like you can see the whole person as a friend and then it continues to progress. Funny enough, I was just at a wedding at the beginning of the month and the couple like were both dating different people when they first met, but they were all in the same friend group and would like hang out all the time. And then over the course of a year or two, like they ended up breaking up with their respective partners and process and everything like that. And then they were all still in that friend group and they were all still friends. And then that friendship started to turn into like a little bit of a romance and there was a spark. And then sure enough, like they got married. And I think you're spot on. It's anecdotal. And I also think there is a little bit of like data evidence to back up like trying to just become friends with someone first versus just cold approaching someone for the romance of it.
I mean, it's a very A to B sequence. It's almost like if you find someone attractive, but and you already know they have a good personality, I feel like there's already foundation for it.
100%. 100%.
I hinted at it earlier. Maybe this problem could be solved by just the simple addition of forcing yourself to go to these run clubs, the intramural teams. And I do want to have a, like, I don't know how much you know when it comes to like the brain, when it comes to stuff. I don't know a lot, and I do feel like it is a very scary thing. Pornography, I think, is actually killing a lot of young men.
Yeah.
And I tell my friends, I think this is a conversation I really want to have. I don't know whether it's with the neuroscientist, I don't know what it is. I truly believe that, and I'm maybe like I'm wrong, I truly believe I would say 95% of the men I know either have a problem with some sort of pornography.
Yeah. I think it's right up there with like drugs and alcohol as like the most addictive substance for young men. It's definitely a huge problem. And I think with the rise of the internet, it's just become that much easier to access, hide, engage with. And it's definitely a huge problem. Happened, like, was something that was very prevalent amongst myself and my friends too, like, especially in college. But something that really helped us was, and I think what's so important about like having good friends is like having an accountability group or like having a group of friends that like you can text or call or just like send a message in. Like there was three or four of us that were in a group early in our sophomore year, I wanted to say, that was like a, yo, if you're ever feeling like a temptation towards pornography or if you're ever like alone and really like about to open it up or whatever, like send a text in the group that's happening, and like maybe someone can come over or someone can give you a call or like just keep texting or like go on a walk or something. And that was super helpful because the thing is like I think a lot of these companies have built like have made tons of money basically having the smartest people in the world working on making something super draining and biologically horrible for you, like as addictive as possible. And so like it's almost impossible to rely on your own internal will to do it yourself, but like surrounding yourself with a group of people that can help hold you accountable to that is something that I think has helped seeing someone like myself and also many of my friends kind of not only fight back against addictions in relation to pornography, but like even kind of conquer an addiction like that too.
Yeah, and I think a big part of what you're saying also revolves around the fact that we need to show a sense of vulnerability. And I'm going to be honest, I'm not the, you know, as a podcaster, you would think I'm very open about talking a lot of stuff. I'm not the most vulnerable. And I do think there is a stigma that, like, it's horrible, but men don't have the capacity or they shouldn't be vulnerable. And I saw Chris Bumstead say that. I thought it was so interesting. Men, sometimes it feels like they need to build up man points before they're allowed to be vulnerable. And this guy's like a heavyweight bodybuilding champion. And now people are like, oh yeah, this guy can be vulnerable because, you know, he's like the manliest of men. I do feel like that stigma needs to be shot down a bit.
Similar to the conversation about money and how it can feel uncomfortable to talk about money when you're first going, like when you're first starting off, like making money, I think similar things like sex and pornography and like physical intimacy is also one of those like taboo subjects that I think there is a time and space to like keep, especially if you have like a partner whom you love and like a good romantic relationship, like there are things that are important to keep between you and a partner, but also like this is where the power of mentorships, this is where the power of like really good friendships comes in, is like being able to create spaces and have a relationship with other people that you can bring to very vulnerably with questions in relation to things like pornography and sex, is again, so important. A lot of young men will first like start engaging with pornography because they are more curious about like what it means to have sex or like what it looks like versus like the actual like temptation or urge of it. And then it ends up turning into that. Versus like being able to surround yourself with people, mentors and friends that you can all like openly and healthily have that conversation, not only prevents you from actually like trying to attack it alone, but like keeps you off of things like pornography, which could then just turn into a rapid addiction.
Yeah, and it takes a lot to be able to say it, but I feel like if you accept it to yourself first, that second step of telling someone might actually be a lot easier than people think.
And I think I agree with you, and I think that because so many people, and especially so many young men, deal with it, it's one of those things that I think everybody wants to say it, but no one can. Feels uncomfortable to everybody, and then when someone first says it for the first time, you're like, it's like,
thank God. Yeah, it's like a weight off your shoulders.
Yeah. Exactly. So I think that's one of the things that helped me initially like raise the question with a mentor, or raise the question with friends, was like this idea of, I imagine that some people are able to relate to this. And the thing is it's true. Like it's a little bit of anecdotal, like feeling like if I feel this, then someone else has to feel this too. But also like the data of how many people, especially how many young men deal with porn or addicted to it. And so it's like both the anecdotal evidence of like, I feel this, other people may feel this, but also like the data says other people have this. So it must be true amongst people that I'm surrounded by. And that's a helpful way for me to like be more vulnerable, is to kind of just go for it. And, oftentimes the things that I feel are also felt by other people that just maybe didn't have as much courage to share it because they felt similarly to what I initially felt, or what you may initially felt, or what other young men initially feel, which is like, I'm the only person that's dealing with this and it feels scary to share that.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be like us like shedding millions of tears. It could be just a very like calm way of bringing it up. And if people can't accept it, screw it. That means they're not the people that you should surround yourself with.
Exactly. Exactly. Doesn't mean that it's not hard, doesn't mean that it's not scary, but it doesn't excuse you from the fact that conversations like these are important to try to not only better yourself, but like just help our peer group and our people in a broader sense as well.
Yeah, and I'm not the biggest sharer, so I'm not like, I don't think Tommy and I are advocating that you share every piece of your life with the people, but if, like you said, I think you said it beautifully, if you know that you have an issue that you think other people probably have, it's a feeling that you know, it's not a bad thing to talk about it.
Yeah. And even if you're someone that's not necessarily a sharer or an oversharer, like we all know those people that love to overshare, it could just be something that you pose as like a question. And like, is this something that you guys deal with? Or is this something that you guys think about or experience? And it kind of keeps you from necessarily having to open up and be vulnerable at first if you still feel like you're not there to take that first step. But it then encourages other people to potentially open up that dialogue for someone that like may be more courageous or maybe an oversharer, as it is to like kind of spark you can be the spark of the fire and then let it warm up a little bit before you can feel comfortable being able to add your own thoughts and experiences.
Completely agree. Tommy, we've talked about a lot today, a really good amount. I'm so happy with this. If I was 20, I am 20. I'm acting like I'm 8 years old. I am 20. As a 20-year-old man, young man, if you were to give me a guide, let's say, of 5 or 3 or even 1 habit or actionable step I should take if I'm feeling lost, what would you say that I should do?
I'll be very tactical here because I think that could be really helpful for like as soon as we're done here, you can go achieve that. Or as soon as you listen to this, you can go do it. And I think it's things that we've covered. I think the first one, and it's 3 things, and they're in relation to the three different pillars that we talked about, or what I would believe to be defined as modern masculinity. The first one in relation to money is go on Amazon or go to your local library and try to find either The Psychology of Money or I Will Teach You to Be Rich by Ramit Sethi or The Almanac of Naval Ravikant. Those 3 books, one of those 3 will have you start the conversation in your mind of what it means to learn to garner resources, which is that first category, masculinity is resources. The second thing is in regards to health. I talked about those 3 accounts to follow on Instagram. I would go ahead and follow Dr. Peter Attia, Dr. Andrew Huberman, and I'm blanking on the third name. Why am I blanking on the third name? And
the Whoop Dr. founder. Kristen,
Dr. Kristen Holmes. If you can follow those 3 people, Dr. Peter Attia, Dr. Andrew Huberman, and Dr. Kristen Holmes, that's just an easy way to start thinking about the conversation in relation to health and gathering more resources in relation to that. And that probably can take you a minute. And that'll just start you thinking along the process. And then I would say the last one is with relationships. I think you could do one of 2 things. I think you may already have someone in your mind, whether it's a professor or a coach or a family friend or an uncle's friend or whatever that you may admire or may think would be a good mentor. Figure out a way to get in communication with them. Maybe it's a text, maybe it's a phone call, maybe it's setting up a time to get a coffee or a meal, and straight up ask them if they would be a mentor for you. That's probably the hardest step of the 3 that I just prescribed, but I think that can really help in a lot of different ways. And if you don't really want to do that, then I would go on to the interwebs and think of 1 thing that you're interested in. Maybe it's playing a sport, maybe it's doing improv, maybe it's learning how to play guitar, whatever that may be, and just look up local fill-in-the-blank class near me. And that's going to be able to put you in third spaces with people that you could potentially become friends with. I would say those are 3 super tactical ways about how you can try to model the behaviors of what it means to be a good young man in today's society.
Yeah, and I think all of these require the idea that the only way to actually get it is if you truly want it. So yes, you want it, but make sure you take the action to get it. And I think that's brilliant because those 3 are very simple, maybe complex, but simple steps to take.
100%. It's all about the action. It's all about it.
Tommy, this has been one of my favorite conversations. I'm so gassed. I always ask my guests, what is the best advice they've ever received?
The best advice I've ever received is actually a good one in relation to this topic. And it's life's about experiences and doing those experiences with the people whom you love. So live life to experience, to do new things, and to especially do it with the friends, the family, the romantic interests whom you love very much.
Love it, Tommy. And this episode is probably going to go out, I think, 2 days after. You're going to be a Mr. and Mrs. So happy, mate. And I'm so gassed about this. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Tommy.
Have loved every minute of it. And wishing you and the pod all the success.